south of the border, down Mexico way. That's where I fell in love when the stars above came out to play. And now as I wander.
Hello there, all you expat wannabes. I'm Johnny Mueller, and you're listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America, the show that tells you just what it's like to live, work, play, and or retire down here in Latin America. It's a mix of the good, the bad, the ugly, and the great, and it's all right here, so let's get started.
You know, I get many, many emails from would-be entrepreneurs up in the States who are telling me they gave it a try, sometimes multiple times. That is, they tried to start a brick-and-mortar business up in the States. But were faced with so much resistance and bureaucracy, they just had to throw in the towel or just shut down an existing business that once was thriving. Now, that might be one of the saddest things of all, having a nice thriving business for years and years, maybe generations, and having to close a town because of the ever-increasing burden of taxes, bureaucracy, and new regs. In fact, I've talked to many gringos and expats who've had fantastic ideas for businesses, but they know it'd be like beating their head against a wall to attempt it up in the States. That's why now, more than ever before, people are thinking very seriously about a plan B outside the U.S., including starting a business once they relocate. They may have done the research, done the due diligence, and realize it's just not going to happen up in the first world. But if done in the third world, it could be a no-brainer. Now, I know you must have heard stories and rumors about how long it takes to get a business started here in Latin America. You've probably heard it takes 6 months, a year to get all your paperwork in order, et cetera, and maybe up in the States it'll take only a month or two, or even just a few weeks. Have you heard that? I have. Well, that's certainly true if you don't know what the hell you're doing. In other words, you may have had a business up in the States, so you think you could pull it off down here all by yourself. You think because you're a first world guy. And you see how businesses here in Latin America, even very successful businesses, seem to be so loose and shoddy. You're thinking with your first world brain and first world ideas, you'll kick ass. You'll beat the pants off of any competition with one hand tied behind your back. Well, that may be true, but first you got to get your paperwork in order. And that's where many gringos and expats get tripped up. Let me put it like this. The only way to get your brick and mortar business started here in Latin America is to hook up with a lawyer right away and have him do all the paperwork. Unfortunately, there are lots of headstrong gringos out there who think they could do it all themselves, take on the bureaucracy. I've yet to meet a gringo who tried to do it all his way, who didn't pull his hair out from day one. So my advice, you let your lawyer do all the paperwork. Stay out of it. You know how to run the business, so you keep him out of that. So then what's the process from day one? You meet with your Latino lawyer. You tell him what kind of business you have in mind. He'll know what kind of paperwork you need, and you won't. There'll be all kinds of documents to get, stamps and seals, paperwork to sign, lard-ass functionaries in government offices to deal with, and it might take that lawyer a month or so to get all that stuff in order. Believe me, it won't cost much at all. Pay him the money, the 500 bucks, whatever. Let him do it all. Even if you think your Spanish is good enough to wade through the bureaucracy, you may be able to pull it off, but it'll take five times as long. Now, the great thing about it is, when your lawyer finally calls and says, everything's ready, you got to sign a few things, and you're off to the races. The amazing thing, and this is truly amazing, except for filing tax forms, you'll never have to deal with the government or the government bureaucracy again. And about those tax forms, they're so minimal and uncomplicated, you won't believe it. Just about equal to what businesses had to face in the U.S. back in the 1950s. Anyway, you'll most likely have that lawyer handle your quarterly tax filings, too. After all, the forms are in Spanish, and you probably won't be able to handle that. Now, remember, we're talking about a brick-and-mortar business now. If you have an internet business, well, let me put it this way. I'd say about 9 out of 10 gringos and expats I know who do have internet businesses in Latin America, they have no involvement with the local government, the tax system, lawyers, or any kind of outside bureaucracy at all. In other words, they just start up a business online and get it up and running without the help of a local lawyer, accountant, or anybody. In fact, I know gringos and expats here in Latin America that have flourishing businesses that they started up on Spotify. They just found a local product or products to buy, and they sell them online worldwide through Spotify. What they do is run it all through this Spotify account, and they themselves do the packaging and shipping. Oftentimes, a whole business like that can be run out of a spare room in your house. So anyway, don't be discouraged if you hear people say it takes 6 months to a year to start a business here in Latin America because the bureaucracy is heavy. The paperwork's immense. Well, yeah, that can be true if you try to do it yourself, but you get a lawyer, he'll do it all for you, and you'll be up and running in a month or so. Again, we're talking about on the level, on the books, registered brick and mortar businesses now. Which brings us full circle back to the fact that so many people up in the States have been writing me lately, lamenting how ridiculously difficult it is to start a brick and mortar business up in the States, or even an internet business. It's getting tougher and tougher to keep a thriving business going, too. Americans with new and good business ideas are hesitant to pull the trigger. That's the situation in the States, anyway. It's tougher than ever, so they're spilling their guts to me. Over the past few years, American guys and gals have been writing frequently, telling me they've got a great business idea or two, but have no intention of even giving it a try, not up in the States. It seems like every last one of those emails starts with a bitter story about a business that never got off the ground or a thriving business that failed, not due to bad management or lack of clients, but for government interference, excessive regulation, and bureaucracy. Oh, and just recently, since that COVIDian thing and massive government money printing, you know, that big round of inflation after QE? Then, of course, every state, starting with California, raised the minimum wage. That alone wiped out thousands of existing U.S. businesses, too. That said, I'd like to read a couple of emails of pain, desperation, and aggravation. Then you'll hear it for yourself. In the words of above-average Americans who've just had it, and why a plan B in Latin America is looking better and better all the time, even for Americans who just a few years back would never, ever have thought of getting the hell out of Dodge. So, our first email's from Dave, yeah? Dave again. This one's Dave number 62. He says, Johnny, and I'll paraphrase a bit, I'm reporting now from the U.S. on the sad state of American restaurants. They are in decay, if you haven't heard. Most fast food places now are charging $15 for a burger and fries. Sit-down restaurants are at least $20 a meal. Along with those inflating prices, the service has gone way downhill as well. He says, you'll find the U.S. traditional mid-grade sit-down restaurant pub food, that includes cafe food or Mexican food, is now at least $15 to $20 for a basic meal, not including the tip. On top of that, Dave says, as you walk into those places, they'll have a help wanted sign on the door. So there's sort of a rotating staff of unseasoned greenhorns, rotund, obese ladies, and immigrants, illegal and otherwise. And you know, when you can't keep your staff, it's rotating all the time. The quality of food is very poor, or at best, hit and miss. He says, for example, one of my latest experiences going to a reputable restaurant, the waitress for sure was rough around the edges, probably a meth head. Rotting front teeth are a telltale sign, you know. So she laid down some dirty silverware and took our order. It was an average order, a sandwich, a burger, chips from a bag. The bill came to $19 a person, plus a 10% sales tax. And then I noticed at the bottom of the check, they had tip suggestions. Get this, Johnny, 30% if the service was friendly and good. 22% if the service was okay or could be better. 18% if the service was poor. Yeah, you got that right. It said, if you get poor service, the suggested tip should be 18%. I always thought shit service, shit tip. So I was thinking, if someone pays less than 30% tip, does that mean there was a problem with the service? Or are you just a cheapskate? So basically, restaurants are starting to demand 30% tips for decent service. I always thought good or decent service was sort of what you'd expect. I left a 10% tip, too much. Anyhow, Johnny, this seems to be a normal and average restaurant experience in the U.S. now. Personally, I usually leave a restaurant feeling like I overpaid for a subpar meal and a subpar dining experience in general. I can't say I have any experience with the fast food joints in the U.S. I've long since found their food quite inedible. I discovered I'd feel sickly an hour or so later. Though sometimes I'll use the restroom in a fast food joint if I'm desperate. In some of those places, when I walk in, I hold my breath. He says, I won't eat in a place where when I walk in, the smell is overpowering. Dave says, even the restrooms are going away in some of these fast food places. They lock the door and put a sign that says, no service. Although working restrooms are supposed to be required in every restaurant, some have real problems, especially fast food joints in the big city, where free open bathrooms attract the homeless and street people and people doing drugs. Then he says, Johnny, have you noticed employees are going away too? When you walk in, there are now many, many digital kiosks to order from. Then he says, Johnny, I travel a lot. I've been to a variety of restaurants in Latin America, some good and some bad. there are some major differences that I'll note here. For one, the food is much cheaper than in the U.S. He says you could spend $6 to $10 U.S. and eat at a very nice upscale place in Latin America. Though not all high-end places have great food, but I have eaten many great meals for $6 to $10 in Latin America. I'm not talking about fast food places either. I'm talking about a nice sit-down restaurant with great atmosphere that would cost maybe $50 or more in the United States. Believe it or not, Johnny, I've also had some very good $3 to $4 meals in Latin America. Lots of mom-and-pop restaurants in that range with good, rich food, spotless decor and bathrooms, and very friendly people. Now, as for the service in Latin America, it's usually much different than up in the States. Most of the time, your waiter or another attendant will watch the tables like a hawk, looking for any sign a client needs them. They're just so glad to help. No listless hangdog looks like so many waiters and waitresses have in the States. Anyway, Johnny, that's my take. Keep up the good shows. I've enjoyed them over the years. Signed, David. Okay, Dave, thanks for that. Let me throw in my two cents here about Latin American restaurants. One thing is very true. The waiters and waitresses are very, very friendly. And believe me, very few are faking it. They really are friendly. And like Dave said, the bills aren't always so much lower than they are in the States. Though I wouldn't know that because I don't live up in the States. I'll take your word for it. Now, here's the confusing thing for expats and gringos traveling to Latin America. When you're in the big city, they'll give you the bill called the factura. You'll see the restaurant charge, and on top of that, there'll be IVA, I-V-A, which is value-added tax, like in Europe. That could be anywhere from 10 to 22%, depending what Latin American country you're in. Then, below that line, there'll be what they call propina, which is tip. That's almost always 10%, calculated right into the bill. So, let's say on average, you're paying 15% tax on top of 10%, so that's already 25% extra over and above your meal. And let me tell you, it's my opinion that when you see that you're paying 25% more, even if it's a very inexpensive meal by all other standards, believe me, no matter how good the service was or how much the waitress smiled, you don't feel like topping up that bill any more than it is. Even worse is when you're in a gringo tourist area like Costa Rica, Cancun, resort areas, etc. In that case, there'll be even another charge on your bill, a tourist tax. And that could be another 10 to 20%. So, let's say, to make the math easy, your meal is $10. Add on to that 15% IVA, you know, VAT tax, 10% propina, tip on top of that. And let's say there's a 20% tourist tax tacked onto that. That's an additional 45% added to the bill. Now, that's enough to outrage anyone. It sure discourages extra tipping. And you know who gets screwed in the end with that, right? The poor waitress. Because when you realize you've been nicked for 45% on top of the cost of the meal, you, like me, are most likely irritated enough. You're highly resistant to kicking in any more for a tip, even though she might absolutely deserve it. I don't know, I'm just saying, that's just me. I personally hate that. That's why I very much prefer going to a mom-and-pop restaurant off the Gringo Tourist Trail. Oftentimes, when you get the bill, it's not even computer-printed. They're still on the pad and pencil system. Many times they don't even add the value-added tax, the IVA, or the tip on that handwritten bill. Just the cost of the meal, exactly as it is on the menu. And if the waiter or waitress has been extra nice, you can really feel good about tipping heavy. Again, just saying. While we're at it, here's one of my other restaurant pet peeves, and why I much prefer being off the Gringo Tourist Trail. If you've noticed, up in the States anyway, people tell me this all the time, when you walk into a restaurant, you rarely get a menu. You've got to scan that barcode and look at the menu on your phone. Well, down here in Latin America, you'll see very little of that unless you're in a very high-end restaurant, most exclusively on the Gringo Tourist Trail, too. Now, I have to tell you, I hate that system. And when I go into a restaurant and they only have a QR code at the table, I'll always tell the waitress to bring me a real menu. And 99% of the time, she'll go in the back room and bring one out. Though I have to admit, a few times, the waitress said, "We don't have physical menus anymore. We only have the barcode." Now, when that has happened, each time, I've told the waitress, "If you don't have a physical menu, I'm leaving." And I'll get up and start leaving. And of course, they'll ask, "Why?" And I tell them, "Because I don't want the spam and the junk mail I'm going to get after I leave this place, because I'm forever in your database." Guess what? Each time I've been in that situation, the waitress will say, wait a second. She'll walk in the back room of the kitchen, and I'm thinking she's going to bring me a menu. She was just lying, right? Well, guess what? She brings out a cell phone. Could be her cell phone, and it's got the menu on it. So I can order from her phone. I don't have to put it on my phone. How about that? Now, I know some of you picky listeners out there might be thinking, well, physical menus are not very hygienic. Especially since the COVID thing, people are hypersensitive about germs and viruses, right? Well, you know what? I don't care about that because once I've touched a menu and ordered my food, I always go to the bathroom and wash my hands before I eat. And I never touch the doorknob on my way out. I always use a paper towel or kick it open with my foot or wait for the next guy to leave and follow him out with the door already open. So in that sense, am I overdoing it? Am I too picky? Well, maybe. But really, you have to admit this whole restaurant thing, since COVID anyway, is getting to be more and more a hassle and less a pleasurable experience. And where it's all going to end up, who knows, but the restaurant experiences are certainly deteriorating. Not so much down here in Latin America, but certainly up in the States. But back to this idea why people report that doing business up in the States is getting harder and harder. With so many existing business owners just throwing in the towel or people with a great idea, just not pulling the trigger. On that subject, you longtime listeners probably remember me talking maybe 8 or 9 years ago. Anyway, a long time ago. I was talking about how easy it is to have a successful business here in Latin America. I was comparing how easy it was to do business down here in Latin America maybe 8 or 9 years ago compared to doing it up in the States at that time. Back then, business school statistics supported the fact that 90% of businesses in the U.S. failed within the first 2 years. Well, I've learned just recently from many entrepreneurs up in the States that projection was highly optimistic. People up in the States are telling me it's twice as bad as it was a few years back. There are twice as many startup failures these days as there were 8 or 10 years ago. Now, in my long run on this show, probably 12 or 13 years now, you've heard me read emails from gringos up in the States who've had businesses that have crashed and burned. Many of them tune into this show because they're looking for another avenue for success. They want to push the reset button and relocate in Latin America. They're entrepreneurs through and through, but want no part of starting a business up in the States. Just too much frustration, too many regs and always more on the way, too much bureaucracy and way too much stress and grief. Now, the thing is, I have lots and lots of listeners up in California. The stories they write about, it always makes me wonder why people, entrepreneurs, want to remain in that state. Sure, there are tons of people leaving California. It's a great exodus. Lots escaping to Latin America. Yet even more stay back and complain while they get beaten to a pulp by the bureaucracy. Meanwhile, millions of illegal aliens with no skills are pouring in, thinking California is the epitome of the American dream, sueño americano. Now, of course, for Americans who don't live in California, they have no idea how bad it really is in the Golden State. Yeah, right, golden. Fool's gold. So in case you were wondering how bad it could get in your own state, because every state eventually follows California, here's an example of bureaucratic madness on steroids in California coming to your state soon. He starts by saying, it happens to be that my brother needs a better paying job. He doesn't have a degree, but he's a hard worker. He doesn't like factory or trade work, but he's always enjoyed working in the food service industry. He's a good cook, too. And I, being his brother, was willing to help. After poking around for some jobs I thought he might enjoy, I came upon the idea of a hot dog concession cart. When I suggested I'd help him with the idea, he was ecstatic. I did the homework. I found a hot dog cart owner who is willing to hustle can easily earn 6 figures. I'm not joking. Simple math says a vendor selling $2 hot dogs with a 30% overhead would only need to sell 250 dogs a day, 5 days a week, to earn $100,000 in annual profits. And that doesn't include the real money makers, which are combo deals and sodas, etc. Most customers will buy 2 dogs, so that's 125 customers a day. Perfectly feasible in the right location here in California. I thought it's perfect for him. He thought that too. At least, that's what we thought at first. So I began the process of due diligence. The first thing I ran into was a mammoth wall of bureaucracy called the California Environmental Health Regulatory Agency. He says, let me tell you of some of the utter insanity I experienced. First of all, I discovered the regulations are completely engineered to make entering the food cart business virtually impossible.
I found you can do almost nothing with a concessions card in California other than serve prepackaged snack food. Though at least it included reheated hot dogs. If you want to do anything beyond that, you need to drop at least $70,000 on a full-blown food truck cart. Inspected and approved, of course, by the state of California. Then he says in most states that are not run by the criminally insane like California, a decent used hot dog cart will run you about a grand. It'll come with a cooler, a steam table, and a bread bin. The basic cart system has served billions of dogs to millions of people around the world without incident for probably 100 years now. Turns out most states, unlike California, are not run by the criminally insane. In most states, a cart owner can keep his cart at his house and he can do the prep work in his own kitchen. In California, you can't do it. It's illegal. In most states besides California, a hot dog cart isn't required to undergo a yearly $500 third-party certification process. And in California, unlike most other states, you must have your cart equipped with a commercial-grade stainless steel refrigerator and a commercial-grade 5-gallon hot water heater. He says in California, unlike other states, a hot dog cart owner is required to have 3 separate stainless steel sinks separated by a 6-inch high backsplash. Oh, and in California, you can't sell your hot dogs within 1,000 feet of a park, 300 feet of a business that sells food, or on a residential street. Yep, he says all that shit must be compliant with in the great state of California. Other states, not yet, but, you know, California is always the bellwether. Even so, not yet discouraged, when I began going through the cart approval process, I found a really nice cart online that had a cooler and a hot water heater installed. When I submitted the cart design to the California regulator, his response was, it needs to have a commercial water heater as well as a commercial refrigerator unit. Does it have those? If so, please designate the make and model and resubmit your application. So I submitted it. He rejected it again. He said, we need an actual tank-style water heater, no on-demand or tankless-type heater. That's right, folks. The new modern tankless water heaters aren't good enough for California. Then I asked him to provide me a reference code that says I can't use a tankless heater. His response was from Section 114325 of the California Food Safety and Sanitation Code. It says, quote, on a mobile food facility that only utilizes the water for hand washing purposes, a minimum 1/2-gallon capacity water heater interconnected with a potable water supply shall be provided and shall operate independently of the vehicle engine. Then the guy, the inspector, replied, instantaneous water heaters, on-demand heaters, are allowed on carts that only do hot dogs or where the water is only used for washing hands. But again, it would not have to be commercial grade, whereas the one you showed me in your application is not. Typical bureaucrat doublespeak. So, in effect, hot dog carts can have tankless water heaters. It's just that the one I showed him in my application wasn't good enough for him. Oh, and that was just the beginning. I also discovered that hot dog carts are required to be kept at a commercial commissary, which is like an RV park for carts. In other words, you got to pay rent to someone else to park your cart at night. Heaven forbid you store your cart in your own garage or in your own pantry or kitchen. And then you need an annual vending permit and business license for each city your cart will be working in. Riverside, California alone charges over $500 a year for that permit. And then you also need a recurring food manager license paid every year, too. And don't forget your food handler license paid yearly, too. And don't forget you need a state business license paid yearly, too. And a federal ID tax number as well. Oh, and did I mention in California, if you want to park your cart and sell for more than an hour at any location, you need to get a signed statement from the business with a bathroom you're nearest to and then submit that statement to the county you're operating in. Oh, and you must submit your menu and your route to the county for approval. And if there are any changes in your menu or route, you must submit those changes to the county for their reauthorization. By the way, California is also one of the few states that imposes double taxation on business profits. So then I tried to do the numbers. Assuming my brother was able to sell 100 dogs a workday, that's 260 days a year, at $2.50 a dog, he would generate $65,000 in total sales. And after I estimated all food expenses, I estimated he'd make $35,565 a year for himself, net. Not too shabby for a tiny small business, but hey, once you get a couple of carts on the road, that's real money, right?
The problem, though, is this is California we're talking about.
Once we accounted for Uncle Sam's cut, California and Big Uncle Sam, for licenses, fees, and all the other crap we talked about, I figure he'd be left with around $17,300 a year. Hell, in California, you make more than that as a couch potato on welfare. So instantly, my brother would be in the category of the working poor. He'd certainly have to sleep under that cart every night because he couldn't afford rent, not in California. But I kept thinking there must be a way to make this business work. So I decided to calculate how many hot dogs he'd need to sell a day to make that business work. I cranked the numbers and he'd need to sell 139 hot dogs or 59 combo meals a day just to break even. The risk there being having to buy an extremely expensive cart and then not being able to hit those numbers. So, needless to say, there's no way a guy with a hot dog cart in California is able to make a comfortable living. I don't know what it's like in the rest of the states, but as far as laws, regs, and bureaucracy, things always happen first in California, and eventually, they're rolled out in every other state. The small businessman is doomed. You just can't win. Signed, Michael S. All right, meet Johnny here. You know, what he's describing is so different from the way you can do business here in Latin America. If you want to sell food, any kind of food, have a food truck or a little cart right in front of your house, a mobile one on the street, whatever, or just a little food kiosk out in your driveway, just go ahead and do it. No one will stop you. There's no food cart police. In fact, talking to a lawyer or two, I understand if you have a food truck, all you need is one license. That's it. What's called a sanitary permit. Your lawyer will take care of that for $35 to $50, and that's it. No inspections, no nothing. Hey, I don't know anything about the restaurant business or the food truck business or food cart business. Personally, I'm not interested. But I do know an expat gringo who set up a Texas barbecue sort of food cart business. You might not believe this, but he nets over $50,000 a year. He's got a little mobile food cart. He only works 3 days a week on weekends. And he's only got two or three full-time grunt-working employees. In fact, if you're ever in Guatemala and take a trip to Lake Atitlan, the most beautiful lake in the world, just ask about Smokin' Joe and his food cart. He's got a Texas barbecue that's out of sight. And I bet he's got all of $3,000 invested in equipment. And he packs it all up and hauls it around in a tiny two-wheeled trailer. Makes $50,000+ a year. You gotta see it to believe it.
South of the border. You've been listening to The Expat Files, Living in Latin America. If you need some help with your own Plan B, we can schedule a one-on-one phone or Skype consult. Just send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. And if you want to get on the waiting list for my next week-long Expat Insider Seminar in Central America, where you're guaranteed to get a 2 to 5 year head start on your Plan B, send me an email, theexpatfiles@gmail.com. Nos vemos.